AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Captain's log, stardate 47488.2. The Enterprise is in orbit of the Kaldus colony, where we have dropped off Dr. Crusher to attend her grandmother's funeral. But a mysterious entity seems to have previously inhabited her grandmother and is now focusing on her. Welcome back, Trek fans, podcast regulars, and ghost hunters. This is the second episode in our series of hit or miss Star Trek podcasts, looking at unpopular, controversial, or infamous episodes. I am your regular host and commanding officer on these missions, Captain Mike Wilson. I'm without my usual number one DK this week, but fear not, helping me to clear out the holodeck filters this time are two returning guests. First of all, Dag, welcome back. You ready to talk all things, next gen?
I'm never not ready, Mike.
You certainly look it, and awesome. And we are also joined by another returning guest, Nita from the Sci-Fi Queens. Welcome back, Nita.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
And I know you're used to talking various sci-fi things and Star Trek, and you've even been on our other movie podcast and everything. So I know you're going to be raring to go.
Oh, this episode, yes.
Speaking of this episode, this time around, we're going to be reviewing the infamous, much memed Next Generation episode, Sub Rosa. So set down your ghostly sex candles and put the kids to bed, because Dr. Crusher is about to get freaky. Oh my. but as regular listeners will know, we don't just dive straight in. We like a little bit of foreplay here. Sorry, the episode's already affecting me. And so I'll begin with a little intro and chat with our guests in a section that I call Hailing Frequencies Open.
Hailing Frequencies Open, sir.
So, I'm sure we've talked to you before, as you've been on before as guests, about your favorite, things in the Star Trek universe, characters and stuff. But I tend to always want to ask things about the kind of theme that we're looking at. So, I asked previously your favorite Romulan episodes for that series, etc. So I have a couple of questions related to what we're looking at now. And the first one would be, is there anything specifically in the Star Trek universe that you really hate, or that you think, Let's the Slide Down is not really the best representation of Trek? And Dag, I'll come to you first.
We're talking anything, like not just this episode, right?
Oh yeah, anything at all you want. I mean,
Oh man, every filler episode of DS9.
I see what you mean. Yeah, the first couple of seasons are rough. Before we actually get to the Dominion War, there's some, oh boy, some rough
nobody. We don't talk about shadow play. We're never going to talk about Meridian, another romance episode.
Unfortunately, next week we are talking about one of the season one filler episodes, but I shall leave that to reveal later.
Oh, please let it be Move Along Home.
Oh, I hate that.
I used to go with the fandom on that, but now I'm like, dude, it is in a world where some of my best times have been spent in escape rooms. It is the best escape room episode of Star Trek. Fight me.
It's definitely the best Star Trek earworm. You, every time you watch it, you will just be singing "Alla Moraine, count to four" just for the rest of the week. Anyway, cool. So what about you, Nita? Is there anything that you kind of wanted to mention that you're not a fan of, maybe in the Trek universe?
I have to say they don't do romance episodes very well. Not all of them, but I would say most are just not written very well. And I just think they have a hard time combining the idea of space and travel and being in, you know, on a track, in a space track, with romance. And I'm not really sure why, but they do seem to have issue with that. And I think that, you know, in the beginning, when they started to incorporate cultures, they kind of failed at representation properly. But I think that as the years have gone by, they have done a really good job of streamlining that and of fixing that. But in the beginning, representation was rough for a lot of people. And this episode,
Yeah. Wow. Again, I've said this off air, and I'll say it again. At least it's not Code of Honor, you know.
Oh gosh, I'm with you on that.
Yeah, Trek's not Trek's finest hour, that one. But no, I kind of I have to say I 50% disagree with you on your kind of assertion about romance. I agree that they're terrible when it comes to one-off romances, but the actual romances between sort of the long-term characters and the main stars of the show, I think, work quite well. I think, and specifically of the way they wrote like Worf and Dax or Tom and B'Elanna and things like that, I think those episodes where they focus on that can be really good. But you're right, like I can't think off the top of my head of a single.
There are only three. Riker and Deanna, Worf and Dax Jadzia, and Tom and B'Elanna. I can't think of any other romances that have worked.
I can think of a few others that work all right. I mean, T'Pol and Trip. I'm kind of a fan of on Enterprise.
I don't know. That was creepy to me. I thought
he was
creepy
by that.
Discovery had a couple. I mean,
Colbert. Yes. Oh, I forgot about those two.
But yes, if we're gonna go back to like Golden Era Trek, and I'm gonna pitch this controversially. Ooh. It's not really a one-off, but it's kind of a one-off. Looking for Parmok in all the wrong places. Because it sets up Worf and Jadzia really nicely, and they kind of take off from there. But like,
yes,
Grilka and Quark had some chemistry, and that was undeniable.
They should have kept it going with that storyline because I think those two actually worked, and they didn't. So in a way, they failed in that romance because they didn't allow that to flourish.
So yeah, we'll end on a more positive note then, because I'm going to go around again and ask: is there anything that's generally, you know, the general consensus is that it's not particularly good, or it's not really well received or well loved by fandom, that you actually think is unfairly maligned and that you are maybe a fan of, or at least would say is overhated? And Dag, I'm going to come to you again first on this one.
Unfairly maligned. Possibly the episode we're about to review.
Okay.
I have already said my feelings about Move Along Home.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
I don't know. I think, like, because I watched all of that when I was a kid. You know, I was a teenager when Classic Trek era ended. I was 22 when Enterprise went off the air. So looking at it from, like, the lens of adolescence and young adulthood, there are plenty that have been recontextualized as an adult where I watch it. I'm like, that's relevant now. I just wasn't old enough.
Yes, yeah. That's true. I go back and watch episodes and go, okay, I can appreciate it differently now.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a couple of things, definitely a couple of episodes that I thought were boring when I first saw them as like a teenager like you, that I would now look back on and I'm like, this is actually saying something really poignant. But as a kid, obviously it just went right over my head and I was like, this is boring. It's just talky. Mm-hmm.
Like what do some people call like the best episode of the first season of DS9?
I love Duet personally.
Right. And that's the one that's largely discussed as like, wow, it's so profound. It's so deep. As a kid, it was like, why are we doing another Bajoran episode? I want to see Cisco. And I feel that way a lot because like the Bajoran arc when I was a kid was like, oh, I'm going to skip this week. I don't care about Beryl. I don't care about Opaka. Battle Lines was really entertaining. But other than that, I was like, meh. But now I rewatch it and I'm like, I love Kira. Gosh, I love Kira. Awesome. That woman has been traumatized more than Deanna. Holy crap.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, so what about you, Nita? Same question. Is there anything that's kind of unfairly maligned for you or anything that
I personally judged Star Trek Enterprise really harshly when it first came out. I had a hard time watching it. And it was just, I felt like, ugh, this is not Star Trek. But it is Star Trek. And rewatching it as an adult, well, older adult, I was an adult when it came out. I think I was a young adult. So it was really difficult to see the importance of those episodes when they first came out. And then in rewatch, I could see the importance of the episodes. I can see the importance of them doing the things they did the way they did it, not having that prime directive, not having the, you know, Federation behind them, being alone out there and making the decisions that he made more sense. Not that they necessarily all were great decisions, but they made more sense. And it really paved the way to a lot of more futuristic episodes in other Star Trek that came afterwards, when they talked about, you know, oh, remember the Zindi War? Well, nobody was going to say that it had not been for Star Trek and Enterprise. You know, they hadn't, because that didn't exist prior to those episodes. And the impact that series had in the Trek world, it was something that I don't think I appreciated. So I had a really hard time appreciating when Star Trek Enterprise first came out.
Well, so that'll kind of conclude our little sort of intro chat and a little bit about, you know, tastes and things. So we're going to move on to the next section, which is the section that gives the podcast its name, and that is the hit or miss section.
What about my performance?
I'm not a drama critic.
Excuse me. Now, you've both been here before, so I'm sure you probably would have had these last time, unless we were reviewing a movie. But if anybody happens to be new here or needs a quick refresher, what I do for the hit or miss section is just basically put up things from anywhere in the Star Trek universe. If you're watching on YouTube, I'll have them up on screen, and I will have them up for our guests here to be able to see in case they need a refresher or anything. And then I basically ask if the thing in question is a hit or a miss. We go around, ask everyone individually, see if we can come up with a consensus and debate back and forth if need be. And I do try and dot in a couple of things related to the theme of the series. So there might be a couple of things related to either the episodes we're reviewing or episodes that are not well regarded, etc. But it won't be the entire hit or miss section, because I just want a few other things just for fun as well. So, yeah, are we all ready for the hit or miss this week?
Let's go.
Let's go.
Awesome. And I should say nobody other than me knows what's coming in advance. So it really is a kind of on the spot for our guests. And we get hopefully
questions beforehand. How am I supposed to win?
Unbiased reaction. So, yeah. So the first thing on the list for this week, it'll be clear why this particular character comes up. But hit or miss for the character of Beverly Crusher. And okay, Nita, you gasped, so I'll come to you first on this time.
Okay, so is it a hit or miss on this episode or Beverly Crusher in general?
I'm talking the character from overall, everything from Encounter at Farpoint to the end of Picard season 3. You know?
She is amazing from day one. I was not a fan when she had taken that leave of absence or whatever it was, when she disappeared for a whole season or something.
Yeah,
behind the scenes.
Yeah, she got fired, right? That's what it was. They did the right thing in bringing her back. She was amazing. She really owned that character. She developed it, and I think that she fit in so well. And I think when I first saw Star Trek Picard, I couldn't, in her episode season, that last season came up, I couldn't wrap my head around her character development. It's like, she wouldn't disappear. That's not who she is. But she wasn't making decisions as Beverly Crusher. She was making decisions as a mom. And I'm thinking, well, would a mom disappear with her child to protect her child? And I'm not a mom, but I'm thinking maybe, yeah. And I can see now and appreciate now that character development that she had at that and Star Trek Picard. And I think she's an amazing character. She is such an inspiration. I love that she's down to earth. She's brilliant. But I don't think that part of who she is was really showcased but she truly was brilliant as a doctor. And I love her character.
Awesome. Fair enough. Dag, over to you. I can see you've been itching to chime in on this one.
No, really. Like, this is the agreement mode, because okay. I think Crusher crushed it.
Yeah.
you know, 4 out of 4 candles for Crusher. honestly, like, you said something that was really important. Like, she's reacting as a mom, and, you know, what she's doing to protect her kid. And I'm like, that has so much, that resonates so hard when you're like, she lost a son. Like, mm-hmm. Wesley disappeared, and we don't have any canon stuff that says Wesley was around for those 10 years that he was gone.
Yep.
We do. We do actually have a canon reunion now, though, which was really sweet in Prodigy season 2.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's what, 12 years later.
Yeah,
exactly.
And he gets to meet his little brother, which is great. And I love that they insert that in there so that at least Picard season 3 feels a little less disjointed for her and her character. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I feel like they, you know, for that specific season, they kind of pulled like a 7 of 9 where they're like, we're going to have Crusher out on the fringe doing stuff over here and right. gone for 20 years. And, you know, the narrative choice to add that kind of conflict between the characters, I kind of disagree with, because they had such a rapport that it's a disservice to the legacy of the previous writers and these characters to split them up like that, like that. Like, they could have been other ways, but like that. Probably not the best choice. I do agree, like, Crusher was a genius that time that I think it was Arsenal of Freedom, where her and Picard were stuck in a subterranean cavern, and she's like, all right, I'm broken, I need to walk you through how to figure out how to fix me, and, you know, lick this root, how does it taste? Bitter. All right, cool, let's use that. just absolutely awesome. You know, a ruggedly capable doctor in an era of super high tech.
Yeah, and I second everything you guys have said, and it's going to be really boring because, you know, a third hit. But I also would say shout out to, which almost never gets mentioned, the times that she's left in command. I'm thinking particularly Descent, when she takes on the ship and uses the kind of Ferengi solar shield technology to
get
too close to a sun and then destroy the ship. And it's like, she's actually a really capable kind of commanding officer as well. As which, I mean, I suppose makes sense for a doctor, because they kind of have to be quite take charge in these ways. But yeah, it's like you said, she's so well portrayed as being a master of everything from command to like homeopathic remedies to, you know, and I don't love every Crusher episode. I think some writers really didn't quite get a handle on her. And I liked the idea of her kind of having this history with Picard, but I always hated the kind of will they, won't they, you know, it just seemed childish and kind of like, we'd be beyond that by now, surely, of the whole, I want to, but I don't, and whatever.
It was replicative. Riker and Deanna were our will they, won't they.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, but even they, I mean, they didn't constantly do the, like, flirting thing or, ooh, I care about you, but we're not going to actually fully go there. And then, as you say, when Picard season 3 came around and it was like, turns out they have a child together that she just kept from him, and it's like, yeah. Like you, I kind of was iffy at the start of Picard season 3, but I think it kind of, it stuck the landing at the end by the time she'd kind of been brought back to the Starfleet fold and kind of cured the problem and everything in the way that Crusher would.
Finally having the technology for the Enterprise to do its Death Star run was worth it.
Absolutely.
God, no, but okay. Second thing on the list for today is, surprising nobody, I always say this, people will be groaning because they know it's coming. I always like to stick a ship on because I'm a ship guy. And I'll have an image on screen because you probably may not know what this is, depending. Then again, you guys are pretty deep cut trackies, so you might. So hit or miss for the USS Zheng He. Apologies if I'm mispronouncing that. Okay, Dag, it's your turn to go first this time, despite Nita's gasp. So what did you think of this?
You know, I mean, Starfleet figuring out how to copy and paste ships, like, that was okay, I guess.
They used a 3D printer.
I mean, the ship itself is probably cool. I don't know what all its specs and capabilities, and Riker really sold it to that Romulan fleet. But most of my opinion is influenced from the behind the scenes, like, come on, guys, can't we have our hodgepodge fleet show up to give us that little coolness? And also, why does everything have to be copied and pasted?
Yeah.
So, miss. Yeah.
So miss overall. Fair enough. Yeah, I can't disagree with your reasoning. I'll get to my thoughts in a second. But what about you, Nita? What do you think of this ship?
I think she's a beautiful ship. Aesthetically, she's beautiful. I don't know her specs, so I don't know in comparison to the other ships in the fleet how she would do, but she's gorgeous. Not a bad ship. You know, she was intimidating enough even as a copy and paste, you know? And I think that she served the purpose. I don't think it's a hit because I think that we don't know enough about her for it to be a hit. I think in the miss part was that they needed to tell us more about her capabilities of what she's been through. What a ship has successfully been through or what a ship was capable of doing, it really will define for me whether it's a hit or miss. And I don't know that they gave us enough information. I wish there was a third choice, but I got only two, hit or miss. So I'm going to go with miss because I just don't know enough about her, but she is gorgeous. Okay.
Well, we always tend to, if you're not sure, we say soft miss or soft hit.
So
if you want to go with a soft miss, that's fair enough.
That
would still give us kind of 2-1 in favor of miss because I personally like it, but I'm with you. I absolutely detest the kind of cut and paste fleet, the kind of the obvious, oh, we need this that we've decided on having, and can you please invent an entire fleet within a weekend? And what we got was rubbish. But I think what saves it, and I understand not everyone is going to be as geeky as me, so they might not know this, but what saves the entire thing for me is what Star Trek Online did with it when they got the assets and everything that was missing from the cut and paste thing, they basically added. So they gave it a registry and they gave it a deflector dish and they gave it greeblies and all the things you would expect to see, impulse engines and things like that on a ship, which actually vastly improved it so that it wasn't just, you know, a very quick render of this smooth thing with no identifying marks or anything. So, and I think the actual design itself, now that it's actually, you know, got more to it, is really good. I actually have the Eagle Moss model, surprising nobody as well. And it's one of the cooler looking kind of models, the way that it's, I don't know, it has a sort of bulk to it and it has a kind of what seems like, you know, harder metal or whatever, for whatever reason, as if it's got like a blade of armor and it just looks badass. I can buy that it would be, you know, was invented as more of a kind of warship type thing than you might have been used to. You know, it's similar to the Defiant, but with a more starship profile. So yeah, without rambling too much, I like the design of it and I like the way it was portrayed in Star Trek Online and subsequently in Picard season 3, although it was so far in the background every time it was in season 3 that you wouldn't have known. But again, they did use it and they used the upgraded one with the actual better, you know, upgraded assets and things. So I kind of would love to see it again and see it closer and see it have a more hero role, because I do think it's a cool design and it's a shame that first appearance was so horrible, frankly, because it was too rushed. But either way, we're gonna have to call that a miss because I'm outvoted, I think, on this one. So for now, it's a miss. Hopefully, if we see more of it in future, you guys might come around on the design, at least on it. Hit or miss for the Voyager episode Fairhaven, and I forget who's going first. Dag, why not? You can go.
Oh jeez. Okay, so I'm going to preface this with I'm an American who lives in California who does not know a whole lot about the culture presented in Fairhaven, but I have a really good friend who lives near Dublin who tells me it's the worst thing ever for Irish representation in Star Trek besides Up the Long Ladder. So if there's a such thing as like an ultra mega miss, I'm just going to go there.
Fair enough. Yeah, I should have pointed out, in case the audience doesn't know this, that my granddad was Irish and I do have an Irish passport. So yeah, I feel I'm uniquely qualified to talk about the authenticness or lack thereof.
Sounds like a bias, Mike.
Yeah, Nita, we'll come to you next on this one.
Okay, so I like the interactions and the distractions that these characters get from the crew gets from this, you know, holodeck program. They're alone in space. They just go through so much. And this place offers a relief of that and kind of makes them feel closer to Earth. But again, bad representation. I mean, it's so outdated that you could even say, well, Tom got the information wrong, because throughout time, information tends to kind of get passed on and get changed. And
don't make excuses for them.
I'm not trying to make excuses. I'm just saying, I'm trying to figure out, you know, where the thinking was, because, I mean, how easy in the 90s it would have been to, you know, look up Irish culture and gotten this Fairhaven correctly. It would have been fairly easy, okay? This is not the 70s or the 60s or the 50s where information was hard to come by. This was a time where information was fairly easy to come by. And I think that that is something that Voyager tends to continuously miss. They miss on the Native American representation. They miss on a lot of representation that they get wrong. They mix it with other cultures and they go, the people are too stupid to see our mistakes.
Let's we are Americans.
It's very true. Yeah, at least you and I are. But I feel like this is really bad. So this is, you know, I like the idea of what they were trying to do. I just think that they executed it very poorly. So it's a miss for me.
Yeah. See, I don't think they were bothered about accuracy, because it's supposed to be like, you know, a few centuries ago, and it's not meant to be the current day. But they're less interested in, you know, the reality of like this romantic notion they've got of how they see. And it kind of, without intending to, I've kind of hit on something that also is present in Sub Rosa, where it's just like, ooh, the mysterious, you know, part of the British Isles that has that history and everything. And ooh, we can do that as like our version of a fantasy. This, and it's just kind of like, we're not your toys. There's a reality to it. You can really, and it's like, if you're gonna do stuff like that, maybe just invent, I don't know, like have a medieval Game of Thrones type thing where it's history but not real. You fictionalized it, but don't claim that you're being real.
Like Beowulf episode, right?
Going back to Fairhaven, though, aside from the, you know, we haven't really dealt with the actual plot of the episode, which, even if the representation wasn't a little bit dodgy for me, I could maybe hand wave it away if there was a great story, but the episode is just interminably boring. Like, nothing happens. There's, again, I hate to say this, but there's zero chemistry between Janeway and Michael Sullivan. The episode almost gets a pass for the humor of the whole delete the wife situation, just because that's so stupid and laughable, but at least it's memeable, you know? But like, I didn't buy them at all. I never, you know, I'm not one of these Janeway Chakotay type shippers, but at least I can recognize there was chemistry between, you know, Mulgrew and Beltran. But whenever they tried to give her another love interest of the week, like this episode or Counterpoint or whatever, it never worked, because there was no chemistry there at all. And this one was the worst offender for me. And like I said, it was just like, what was the plot? It was like we just stood still for a week, and I don't know. And Voyager, you'd think, would be the most urgent series, that it's like, we desperately need to get home, we can't slow down. And having an entire episode where you're basically just titting about in the holodeck is the worst possible use of your time. But anyway,
Fairhaven. Fairhaven is what happens if, after World War III, the collective works of Charlotte Bronte are considered to be Irish literature.
That's horrible. But so true.
It's so very true. Yeah. But yeah, so I'm going to say miss, and I'm assuming you two probably would have said the same thing.
Oh, absolute miss.
Unfair, Haven. Delete the app.
Exactly, yeah. I shouldn't have really asked that, because you did say ultra, super, mega miss.
Ultra, super.
The next thing on the list, and the final thing, is another episode. It's actually left over from our Romulan series, full disclosure, but I'm just interested in people's thoughts on it. So hit or miss for the Next Generation episode, The Neutral Zone. If you can even really remember it, it's the season one finale. Dag, I'm going to come to you first.
Okay. Epic win. Like, epic hit. Epic. Okay. Everybody on this show by the end of the first season is trying to relate to the characters, and then here come across these 20th century anachronisms that act as our little substitutes to relate at a level to these crew members who have been operating in this sort of like ultra competence porn for the last 20 something episodes. And now it's like, hey, what about banks? What about money? What about baseball? What about television? And Data's just like, yeah, hold your breath.
It's just great the way the guy sees a replicator and his immediate thought is just like, how much do you charge for this? Because you would, wouldn't you? You know?
But, and that Mr. like Offenhaus there is just like, I need to talk to my bankers. Like, bro, it's been 300 years. Do you not understand the concept of time?
Yeah. Well, probably thinking to himself, that's a lot of interest he's accrued potentially. You know? And yeah, I like that part of the episode as well. I'm glad you said that because I always feel like this episode doesn't get mentioned a lot and might not be popular. And I really love that aspect of it as well. I also, you know, being a nerd was just like, yay, the Romulans, they are coming back. And, you know, first appearance of the Romulans, first time you see a warbird, second appearance, of Mark Alamo as a Star Trek alien. But not the last. Not to interject a bit early, but I think this episode's a hit. I like pretty much everything about it, and I just don't think it gets talked about enough, really. But Nita, we haven't heard from you. What do you think of this one?
This is an absolute hit. I think that they got the billionaire's character so accurate. This is the mentality of a entitled individual who believes in his own sense of importance. Yeah. To the point where he doesn't quite understand that there are other things at play here. But I like the fact that when he goes on to the bridge, he's like, that guy's lying. Something's up. Because he knows people. He knows because he lies. And he knows how to manipulate a room with what he's saying and what to do to advance himself. So he was. It was really interesting how here are all these humans in this enlightened time and that are thinking supposedly different. Wealth is not a matter of money, but of accomplishments. And here comes this relic from the past reminding all these humans that you all started out that way, very much so. I love the country boy. He was hilarious. I think the fact that he was more willing to accept his surroundings, he played that part so well. And the mom's grief and the tragedy that she had, knowing that, you know, her family was all gone. And I mean, this I think was a very good episode. I think it had a lot of little storylines in there that I would have loved to see more of, but of course, you know, you only get an hour, and that's understandable. But I think this was really well done. And of course, who doesn't love the Romulans? I sure do. I love to hate them. So yeah, I was so glad when they brought the Romulans back. And I was glad that it took a human from the past for them to see that this guy, this Romulan, he was up to something. And he was keeping secrets. And I thought that was so well done. It is definitely, for me, a hit.
Let's also not forget that it's the start of the Borg arc, because it's when they officially reveal that Outpost Alone was one of being getting scooped up by some unknown force. And we find out later, of course, what that was. So, yeah, I'm with you. I wish we kind of done more with this or we could see another version of it, because there's something inherently interesting about, like, the idea of Roddenberry's, I guess, socialist utopia, where it's like, we've abandoned world economy and we all work to better ourselves now. So that's our driving force. And it's just kind of like the idea that somebody hears this, that we look on as like this dream vision. And this dude's just like, but my money. You
know, I would have liked to have an episode where they go, you know, how did these guys get along? Are they back on Earth already? Mm. Or are they still trying to adjust somewhere? You know, because each of them would have adjusted differently. It would have taken the billionaire a lot more adjusting to do.
That's the thing. That's the one that interests me the most, because it's like he would have been used to being such like status and such power because he was a billionaire. And yet you end up in this time where money's been abandoned. And it's like, you're basically just an average Joe, dude. You're like everybody else, no better, no worse. And would he be able to adjust to that? It would be a very interesting thing to see. So,
one thing I really do love in the beta canon is that Offenhaus ended up becoming the Federation ambassador to Ferenginar.
Oh wow, that makes perfect sense. I didn't perfect know that. Was that from a book or something?
Yeah. There's I don't know what book it. I think it's Debtor's Planet.
That's cool. I like that. Yeah, that was clever of whoever came up with that idea. Awesome. So, yeah, that concludes the hit or miss section. There wasn't too much disagreement or debate, I think. So, yeah, we'll head into the main bulk of the episode, which is the episode review, of course, that I mentioned earlier. And we are going to begin our analysis. As I said, we are analysing the episode Sub Rosa from Next Generation. But before we start, if you've been a regular listener since the Romulan series, you know that I have an idea that I have borrowed, taken, stolen from the Delta Flyers podcast that I thought would be fun to implement, where I actually write two poems for the episode that we're discussing. And I felt like I had to continue it because we're looking at episodes that are particularly notable and maybe not as popular. So as I have been doing every week, I've written a limerick and a haiku representing Sub Rosa. And as I always do, I'm going to ask you guys which one you want to hear first, and then whichever one's left, I'll hopefully remember to read out at the end of the review of the episode. So limerick or haiku, what do we want to hear first, guys?
Limerick for me.
I'll go limerick.
Awesome. Fair enough. So just before we get into the actual bulk of the episode, then, this is my limerick to try and sum up Sub Rosa. Crusher lands on a planet of Scots, and for Ronin, she soon has the hots. Family death she can't handle, so she has sex with a candle, and its mist is the colour of snots. I struggled for a last rhyme on that one, I won't lie. But, yeah. So hopefully we all appreciated
that. I appreciate that one so much. I like it.
I appreciate the ambiguous reference to mists, which could be taken in many contexts.
Didn't think of that, but let's pretend that was deliberate, I guess. So yeah, and again, before I get into kind of the behind the scenes and talking about the episode, I always go around and ask this, so I'm going to do it here. Can you guys remember the first time you saw Sub Rosa and what your initial thoughts were? Dag, I'm going to come to you first, because why not?
Yes, I was 11 years old and I was like, ew. But then watching it with my mom and my godmother and her kids, I was the only one in the room to go, McFly, mom, look. So, you know, we'll get to that in a minute.
Oh, that's in the BTS. Very definitely. But yeah, fair enough. So you just remember thinking, ew, cooties, maybe.
Because you were too young. 11-year-old, yes.
Fair enough. And what about you, Nita? Can you remember your first time of watching the
episode? Well, yeah, I remember when it first aired, watching it, because I believe I might be the oldest person in this room. Oy vey. So I was in my... I don't know. I had to be in the 90s, so maybe I was in my 20s. I just did not understand why she felt such strong feelings so quickly. It was very confusing at the time. I don't understand why the writers wrote it that way still today, but I understand that what she was feeling was not love. I understand that now, but I was kind of taking it at face value when I first saw it. I'm like, how could she be in love with him? Ew, how do you fall in love with someone who was in love with your grandmother? You know, like, my grandmother was my bestie. I'm not trying to date nobody she was dating. So it was kind of on the gross side when I first saw it. Yeah,
there's a little weirdness. Yeah, I wasn't that much older than you, Dag. I think I was maybe 14 or 15 when I first saw it, and it kind of just went over my head because it was Star Trek, so I wasn't expecting anything to be quite as horny. And I think I was just in denial about it, and I was looking forward to the bits that were, you know, the nerdy stuff I was interested in, like the weather control system and the starship plot, and you know, even Picard and Beverly and the way that they kind of interact and he comes to a rescue kind of thing. But yeah, rewatching it now, I'm just kind of like, how did this go over my head when I was really old enough to be able to know that a lot of these double entendres are, let's be honest, single entendres that are just, they can only really be interpreted one way. And yeah, I felt a bit innocent and naive that it just went over my head the first time around. All right. Well, we've got lots to get into, as you can imagine. But before we get into the actual bulk of the episode and the little categories, I do have a behind the scenes section, which I'm going to have to read out because DK isn't here and he would normally be the one to do it. So, again, apologies if it's a little dry, but hopefully there's some interesting stuff. And if you guys want to chip in at any time, Dag or Nita, feel free to jump in. So, yeah, I'm going to start by telling you at a convention in the 1990s, Michael Dorn mocked the episode as being a ripoff of Anne Rice's The Witching Hour. Literally translated from Japanese, Ronin means drifting person. Generally, however, it's used to refer to a samurai warrior who lacked a master. Brannenberger made up the name before learning the meaning in Japanese, apparently. As Dag alluded to earlier, as in-jokes, the gravestones in the episode bear the names of various movie characters, including McFly from Back to the Future and Vader from Star Wars. And yes, I noticed that every time during that big confrontation with Ronan at the end. And I'm like, Vader McFly, woo!
And grandma using force lightning, come on.
That's a good point, actually. Oh, boy. So yeah, this actually also relates back to something you mentioned earlier, Dag. The notion of Beverly's grandmother being a healer can be traced back to the first season episode, The Arsenal of Freedom. Injured in a subterranean cavern, Beverly uses the medicinal knowledge of roots and herbs learned from her grandmother to assist Picard in treating his wounds. Sorry. This is a really geeky thing that I love. The control panels that are seen in the weather substation appear to use a late 23rd century layout. This is consistent with Maturin's comment that the weather control systems are almost a century old. Yes, I noticed that because I'm a big old nerd. Rene Echevarria recalled, I can still reduce Brannen to shudders when I go into his office and say, I can travel on the power transfer beam. But the cast loved it. Every woman on the lot who read it was coming up to Brannen and patting him. Ultimately, I think it was worth doing because it was campy fun and the production values were wonderful. The sets looked great and everybody threw themselves into it. Gates did a wonderful job. It just got bigger and broader and to the point of grandmother leaping out of the grave. Just having Beverly basically writhing around having an orgasm at 6 o'clock on family TV was great. For that alone, it was worth doing. We got away with murder. Really? I mean, come on. Naran Shankar was one of the story's early opponents and said, it's a gothic ghost story. Either you buy it or you don't buy it at all. And I was sort of in the latter category. And finally, Ronald D. Moore stated, I kind of liked it. I thought it was good to try a different genre on Next Gen and mix things up a bit. It's not a perfect show by any means, but I'm glad we did it. So, yeah. Anything there shocking or revealing to you guys?
One thing I noted was that the writer who pitched this episode was a woman named, I'm going to get her name wrong, Gianna Gallo.
I have it in my notes for writing. Actually,
Gianna
F. Gallo.
Yeah, I don't know if you were going to bring this up later, but I'm just going to do it now. I love the fact that she went from this episode to the episode of Voyager with the dinosaurs.
Oh, I didn't know that, but okay.
She pitched the idea for that eventually became Distant Origin.
Wow, I didn't know that, but that's cool. So that's a bit of BTS I didn't have.
She was also one of the people who participated in the writing campaign to save Star Trek in the 60s.
Oh, no way. I didn't know that either. Yeah. Wow, that's huge. Okay, awesome. She saved Star Trek so that we could have a sex ghost candle story. So.
Outlander in space. Fight me.
There's so many things this has been compared to. It's been compared to Anne Rice and Outlander, as you said, and for me, it always came off very kind of Danielle Steele, if that's a reference that doesn't go over our audience's heads.
Oh, my gosh.
It was very kind of romance melodrama kind of thing, you know?
You know, yeah. I've never been a romance reader at all. That just never really called my attention. Maybe that's why I wasn't, when I saw this originally, was like, why is this happening? Yeah. Why is this the focus? Why not the weather panel? Why not anything else?
Anyhow, the way that I do the reviews is just to break down into sections just so it's easier to understand, as I always let the audience know. So things like writing and plot, directing, acting, sound and music, VFX, production design. But if the conversation flows a different way, I'm happy to follow it there. We don't necessarily have to stick rigidly to it. But just for the sake of organizing my notes, first of all, I'm going to ask if you guys have any initial thoughts on the writing and plot before I jump into my cold hard facts about it. Nita, I'm going to come to you first. Do you have any thoughts on the writing and plot you want to share overall?
I think that they were out of, I feel like this episode was like, we're out of ideas. We need something to spice up the ratings. Oh yeah, that'll work. Like no one really thought about it very much.
Yeah, fair enough. And what about you, Dag? Any initial thoughts on the writing?
Okay, so as an 11-year-old watching this episode with really no sense of identity outside of myself, I didn't understand this episode. I didn't care so much about this episode. I liked the Vader McFly part of it, but it didn't really hit me until I was, you know, well into adulthood that I'm like, man, women really love this episode because it's really like how many times did we see Riker be like, hey, and fade to black? And we were all like, yeah, that's perfectly normal. What a stud. And then the one time Beverly gets to have a scene on camera and we're all like, I don't know.
But they wrote it cringe.
Sure, but
there are differences.
Maybe it, I mean, they wrote it cringe, but then we have Twilight and then we have Outlander, yeah. And then we have like a whole bunch of other like of these things that are also cringe that like pave the way for not cringe.
I get your point that Riker was a playboy and he was always, you know, the implied sleeping around and whatever, but at no point did Deanna basically essentially walk in on Riker masturbating. That's what Picard does with Beverly in this episode. Cool. Well, I'm just going to drop some facts about the writing and the plot before we can get a little bit more into it. It might actually give us some conversation that can spur from there, because it's interesting where it comes from. As Dag said, Sub Rosa originated from a pitch by freelance writer Gianna F. Gallo. Jerry Taylor, who wrote the teleplay, said the original spec script was that there have been aliens throughout history on Earth who had possessed people, and they were responsible for much of what we call supernatural paranormal events. That writer had the idea of the Scottish kind of origins of Beverly. Rick Berman and Michael Piller were very distrustful of this story. They considered it a romance novel in space and felt the possibility for embarrassment was monumental. But I just knew it would work. It's a different kind of story for Star Trek to tell. It is a romance, but we do have women in our audience, and women do traditionally respond to romantic stories. Yeah, okay.
She didn't say respond positively. She just said respond.
Yeah, well, this is true. I kind of agree with Rick and Michael on this one. But anyway, Jerry Taylor denies that the story is inspired in any way by Anne Rice's The Witching Hour. She explained, one of writer Brannon Braga and my favorite movies is The Innocents. Great movie, by the way, which comes from Henry James's Turn of the Screw. We saw this episode as an homage, and we packed in every sort of gothic ghost story trick that one could imagine. Consequently, the caretaker Ned Quint and Jessel Howard were a homage by Brannon Braga to the valet Peter Quint and the governess Miss Jessel in The Innocents. I actually thought Quint was a Jaws reference personally, but yeah, that one went over my head. And Brannon Braga noted that the show was not popular among who he dubbed hardcore fans. He said, I've come to notice that whenever you infuse a show with sexual themes, some of these fans seem to short circuit. I mean, the weather array malfunction causing thunderstorms, it was fun. Methinks the gentleman doth protest too much. But yeah, that's all I have on the writing and where it came from. And as I said, this is written by Brannon Braga, whose name's coming up a lot during these less than stellar episodes, it turns out. And Jerry Taylor did the initial story. He did the teleplay, or possibly the other way around. And it's stemmed from a pitch by, as you said, Gianna Gallo. So any thoughts on, do you think they were wise to take this on? Do you think they did stick the landing as they kind of seem to think they did? Or because I kind of agree that I think they just ended up looking embarrassing personally, as they feared. But yeah, what do you guys feel about that?
I think they fell. They didn't land. They fell flat on their face. Listen. They wrote this, they pitched this. This person knew nothing about Star Trek, knew nothing about sci-fi, and had a stereotypical view of what women respond to or what women like. And if you are going to write a romance with the idea that, well, we need women to respond to Star Trek more and romance does it, lamp love is not the way to go. Okay,
that should have been the title of this episode. Lamp love.
It was not written by anyone who understood science fiction in any capacity.
Well, I mean, she did apparently want to save Star Trek the original series, so you have to assume she's a Trekkie, the writer. But which I guess makes it even more egregious that she just didn't write the Star Trek episode, or did the bare minimum to get it, make it into a Trek episode. For me, it's kind of shoehorned. I'm writing a romance novel with a ghost. Ooh, I've got to turn it into a Trek episode. I know, something about a weather station. That'll do, you know.
But you see, saying that, you know, she wrote Star Trek, the original series, does not give hope to her. I'm sorry, it just doesn't, because you weren't paying attention. to what sci-fi is about. And I think that one thing that The Next Generation embodied was science fiction, not just Star Trek, the original series influence. And they knew how to write, and they knew how to bring those episodes. This did not bring it. This was just, I think it was a definite miss on that part. This was an embarrassment.
That's fair enough. I'm going to come to you, Dad, because I have a feeling that you don't necessarily agree. You did mention earlier you thought this might be an overhated episode. So what do you think worked a bit better, worked well for you in the episode?
Well, again, I think, you know, I think Beverly should be allowed to, like, enjoy what she wants to enjoy. And it's the 24th century. And if that happens to be the genie in the bottle, let it rip.
Your grandmother's erotic diary, though. I mean,
okay,
she wasn't honestly, just her grandmother, she was the woman who raised her. Let's put that out there.
If this episode was made today, the criticism would be that somebody plagiarized a fanfic off of AO3.
Very probably.
That's what we would call that today. So, I mean, like, but what is an episode that is taken from a freelance writer anything but that writer's, like, desired headcanon made canon by, you know, a treatment by the writers?
That's fair enough.
I wish that we had gotten to know more about, you know, Ronan's people, because, like, the original pitch was, hey, aliens have been interfering with our history for a really long time. And I'm like, hey, wait a second. We already have a whole bunch of aliens, the Davidians, and, you know, people have been coming to Earth for the Roman and Olympian gods. They're all, you know, basically Qs. This is still a missed episode for me. Like, when it comes on in my TNG rewatches, it's background noise until we get to Emperor Grandma doing the whole Force Lightning on Geordi and Data.
That I like.
I believe that didn't occur to me when she's literally doing it in front of a gravestone that says Vader. I never put that connection together that it's just Force Lightning.
I totally should have said Grandma Palpatine. That's so much better.
Beverly. But no, I mean, the only notes I have really are just, as I kind of said off air to Nita, the only notes I have are just like bits of dialogue and stuff where I'm like, did they really do that? And I just have to point them out because they beg a belief in terms of, like, this was the best writing we could do. Okay, the idea is kind of ridiculous, but then you have things like, where was I? Oh, Beverly and Deanna getting really horny when Beverly's talking about, oh, I read an extremely arousing chapter in my grandma's diary, and Troy responding, ooh, frankly, I'm envious. It's just, it's beyond laughable. And then Beverly, you know, she's neglecting the personnel reports and just drifting off in her mind saying, oh, I wonder if I'll have another dream tonight, to which Troy replies, I'd read two chapters. It's just, are we making Star Trek or Carry On in space? Yeah. You
know, exactly. Exactly.
If that stuff wasn't bad enough, then they do the really stupid thing where they give poor Gates McFadden all of the terrible sci-fi, you know, gobbledygook to try and explain it and put it in Star Trek terms. So, I mean, she actually genuinely gets the line, there's no such thing as ghosts. You're some sort of anaphasic life form. Anaphasic energy is extremely unstable. It needs an organic host to maintain molecular cohesion. That's not dialogue. That's just a Wikipedia entry or a Star Trek Memory Alpha entry that she's being forced to read out. Do you know what I mean? It's just, all right.
The camera just pans left to the audience. It's like, thanks for explaining that.
And I have a question, maybe you guys can answer it. Why didn't it occur to any one of her ancestors, especially the grandmother, who was in, one would say, an enlightened age, to, I don't know, scan the stupid candle? No one scanned it. No one said, there's a ghost around here. Let's see what's happening. Not one of these, it makes me feel like they're saying women are too stupid to look beyond what's pleasurable. And that's pretty a bad message.
That's a really good take.
The fact that that's the message that it ends with as well, because it ends with like, oh, okay, so he was terrible and rapey and he, you know, used my family for generations, but he made Nana happy. And it just kind of, Is that the message we're leaving this episode with? Anything's fine as long as you give a woman pleasure. It's just like, no, I don't like that at all. Not a great. And just again, the idea that, like, and as she's giving all this exposition, she has to point out, oh, it turns out it must be that one of my ancestors was compatible with his energy matrix or some gubbins. I don't know. And it's just like, what are we doing here, guys?
Crush in some ways, I'd rather
it was just a ghost. Yeah, exactly. But it also, it falls into the trap of, like, so many things which I hate in dialogue, which for something that has three writers is unforgivable. Like, at the very start of the episode, I don't even remember what Beverly's explaining, but she's explaining something to either Picard or the governor, someone like that, and just goes, well, as you know. And I'm like, if you start a sentence with, well, as you already know, then you don't need the rest of that. You're literally just saying this for the audience's benefit and acknowledging that fact. There's got to be a better way to get this information across, you know what I mean?
And, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It just seemed like there were so many things that, maybe it's because I'm a big old nerd that analyzes media too much, but every time something came up, I was like, well, that's set up for later. You're pointing out that the candle could be used as a weakness. That's going to be used. Pointing out all your ancestors have green eyes. Oh, well, I bet Beverly changes her eyes to green later. Yep, that happens. You know, it's all just like, and to the point that we were making earlier about, like, you know, when they recreate these past cultures on Earth and they just create the most stereotypical version you can possibly imagine.
Oh, I was just thinking about that.
Despite all of the, I mean, there's cringy dialogue galore in the episode, and despite how bad all of it is for being cringy, there's almost nothing worse for me than the governor saying, well, I hope you fix these weather problems. We've got a caber toss scheduled for tomorrow.
And why is it that every time the Scottish people are depicted in you know, quote unquote, in ancient time kind of way, they make them so extra when it comes to being superstitious? Like, take that down a notch. Is that even true? I don't believe it, and I've never been to Scotland, and I refuse to believe it. Do they have their history and their stories? Well, yes, we all do. Every culture does, because we didn't know and we didn't evolve. But these people are not the ancient Scottish people. These are evolved people. This, some of them are not even human, for crying out loud. Yeah, okay, and the stereotype is offensive. It really, truly is.
I don't think that's about being Scottish. I think it's, that's like a cliche character that you always find in these kinds of soft horror stories. There's always somebody that's like, ooh, I am the one telling you the message, and you're not going to listen to me, and you're going to ignore me. And I mean, every horror movie has that, even if, you know, the more extreme stuff, like to the top of my head, Texas Chainsaw Massacre has an entire character whose sole function is to go, ooh, don't go near that place. You're going to end up getting hacked up. And they all go, you crazy person. We're going to carry on anyway. Wow. There's always that kind of idea, you know?
Totally epitomized in Scream with that character who's like, I know how all the horror movies work. And if this character, if this murderer is patterning all of his murders around movies, then here's what's going to happen. And you're that
which,
character.
Which then happens literally behind him as he's watching a horror movie.
Right.
Precisely. Yeah.
We're going to call this character the Tinfoil Tartan.
I mean, yeah, to my earlier point, though, as I said, the name Quint obviously was a reference to The Innocents, but he also has the same function as Quint from Jaws, who's like, oh, don't underestimate that shark. Don't be opening those beaches. You know, there's something out there.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the actual vibe that I got from that character.
Yeah. And I feel bad for, as I said, for Gates McFadden, because she's given it her all, and when she's expected to scream out, you're not Nana, you've been using me and Nana and my whole family for centuries. Ugh. Delivering that with a straight face should get you an acting award anyway, I think.
Absolutely.
Here's a thought. Ronan possessed Jessel in 1647. This episode takes place in 2370. So that's like 700 years and change.
Yeah.
and so you just thinking back, like 700 years and change of inhabiting these Howard women, ultimately we've got this weird non-corporeal alien influencing the women of the family that ultimately leads to Wesley Crusher being able to manipulate time and space.
Somebody did actually say, I didn't have it in the audience response because it was literally, it bleeped just as I was starting recording, but somebody said it's just a shame that we didn't get to Wesley's inheriting the Howard family legacy. Just wanted to see see Ronan hitting on Wesley Crusher. Well, there's no other women left, so, you know.
Yeah,
it's just weird. It's just so bizarre.
Just say, before 1647, Ronan's candle was actually installed at a Cardassian prison camp and was literally the fifth light.
Oh, that's horrible.
Maybe Shakar's actually his child. That's why they're the same actor. Anyway, yeah.
Oh, God.
Do you guys have, do you guys have any thoughts on the writing or the plot?
I just got an image.
Anything that we haven't mentioned, sorry, before I move on to the acting, since we've started talking about that anyway. So anything about the writing or plot that we haven't said that you wanted to share?
No, I'm good.
No, I'm good.
Cool. I'll start us off then by saying about the acting, because again, I've kind of touched on it. Duncan Regier later went on to play the recurring role, as I said, of Shakar Idon in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Dag has issue with the word recurring in that sentence, I think, but there we go. Michael Keenan, who plays Governor Maturin, the alien governor of Kaldos Colony, also appeared on Deep Space Nine as Patrick in Statistical Probabilities and Chrysalis, one of the genetically engineered ones of Bashir's friends. And he also played King Hrothgar in the Voyager episode Heroes and Demons, which you have actually referenced earlier, Nita. So, yeah.
Yes.
In terms of the acting, Gates McFadden was praised for her performance. Jerry Taylor remarked, "The lovemaking without a partner, this is not easy stuff to do, and she committed herself to it completely." Brannon Braga commented, "It was the best performance I've ever seen. I just thought she did a wonderful job. Picard catches Beverly masturbating, for crying out loud. What a tough role to play. When I was writing the words, she writhes around in the bed having invisible sex. I just thought, oh man, we're asking for trouble. Are they going to be able to pull this off? Thanks to the director, Jonathan Frakes, and Gates, it was not hokey. It was very good. Sure, it was racy. Even Rick Berman had said, I can't believe we're doing this. I think they trimmed quite a bit out of the writhing sequences." Oh, my God. Sometimes you just read these things and you can't quite believe what you're reading. And finally, at an Austin, Texas convention in 2012, Gates McFadden stated she wasn't very fond of this episode, saying, "I was basically in love with a lamp. This woman is a doctor and falls in love with a lamp. How the heck does that work?"
Thank you.
So yeah, opening that at the floor then, what do you guys think of the acting in this episode? Is there anything you wanted to say for positive or negative on that regard?
Gates McFadden is such an incredible actress. She did a phenomenal performance. Even though she didn't like this episode, you would have never seen it. In her performance, it did not reflect on her performance. She did an incredible job. I think that the expression is now small parts, just more actors. She took that to the next level in this episode, because this episode would have been no, I'm not doing this. You give this to Diana, Troy, not me. Like, no, I'm not doing this. But she went with it, and she did the job that she was paid to do in a way that was phenomenal. She did a great job.
I hate to be the negative one, but I slightly disagree. I just think she does her best, but it's just so cringe and so awkward that whenever she's like, "Oh, I feel so strange right now," and "Oh no, please stop, no, carry on," and just the whole, like, she's protesting and then gets stopped because he basically touches her in a sexual way, and you can't play that and not have it just be ridiculous.
But that's not the acting, that's the writing. The writing in that kind of scenario, absolutely atrocious. Like, when a woman says no, it means no. And when you have a scene like that, what you're telling people is she doesn't really mean that. Just continue. But that's bad writing. As far as her ability, I think she did well.
It was too cringe for me. I felt awkward. It's like, I don't know, maybe because you'd grown up with these characters or whatever, it just felt like watching your mom be horny. And that's just, Lord, Beverly, just no.
I left it to grandparents, dude. Come on.
I don't mean anything dodgy is going on, but it is kind of like I didn't need to see Dr. Crusher be like, "Ooh, that diary chapter was especially erotic. Ooh, yeah. Diana, it was so good." Ooh.
You know, and here's the thing. Nobody here, I think, is saying that self-pleasure is a problem.
No, I think we're saying
doing it with a candle while reading your grandmother's sexual diary is where the problem is at.
Well, I mean, also the fact that she's, you know, she's at work, for crying out loud. During the scene with Diana, she's not like having a drink at the bar on a Friday night. Discussing personnel reports, and she's like, "Oh, I can't possibly focus. I'm just so turned on by my grandma's diary."
The level of Jesus woman. Yes, the level of inappropriate writing and the scenes and where these scenes are taking place, like her getting, you know, freaky with the candle while she's in the cabin. Literally, you didn't lock the door and you didn't close the door at minimum. And someone walks in on you and you're just, "Oh, Jean-Luc." I would have been like a different reaction, which, you know, I don't want to be explicit, but I would have been screaming and throwing things at him. Okay, I'm Puerto Rican. The reaction would have been different. You just interrupted me. You about to die. Like, that's just what's going to happen.
Something you said earlier really resonates with me about the whole presentation of, you know, saying no and having someone continue anyway, in that sense of like, okay, in universe, there might have been a level of consent there, maybe some consensual non-consent for you people who are like deeper into the kink world. But like, if that isn't explicit in the script, in the way that it's presented, then you get younger people who have immature attitudes about sex going, "Oh, that's how it works. Just keep going until they relent." And you have to wonder, you know, the message for the message at the time in the 90s, predominantly heterosexual, is that if the woman is the one being subjected to it, then implicitly the man is the one performing it. And you have young men who, again, have immature attitudes about sex, who will say, "Oh, I just do that." And you have young women going, "Oh, it doesn't matter if I say no."
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's a harsh message to send to people and repeat in media over and over and over.
Definitely. Yeah. It's a horrible, awkward thing to discuss. But like, I noticed that this time watching the episode, because I'm not, you know, as innocent as I was when I first watched it. But she literally shouts the words, "Stop it." And then he doesn't, and there's no way that's ever fine. It's just
and they make it seem like she just agrees with how she's supposed to perform after saying no.
Like she acquiesces because he just touches her in a private place or something,
and that's not what's happening. It's survival. When a woman says no, and a man continues to do what he's doing, the next step is, I need to do what I need to do to survive. And if that means to let it happen, then that's how she's going to react. Whatever her reaction is, grab something and hit him. But the message that they seem to be sending without too many words, because it's more of a visual message, is just keep going. No means yes. She'll give in and like it. No,
it's just particular thing for me is just very clunkily written. Like, you could have saved it a little bit by just literally having her go, "Stop it." And then immediately afterwards be like, "Oh no, ignore me, don't stop it, I'm having fun," or something. Just some bit of dialogue that gives her back some kind of agency. Exactly. That's not like, "Stop it, oh, you've touched me, never mind, we're just gonna go with this," kind of thing. It's like, there's better ways to do that. And
I guess it's
just clunky, but
you get 42 minutes to tell a story, and we've eviscerated this episode. But if we're going to continue down this line of thinking, you know, the bad message is, "Oh, just give in, it'll be fine." And then down the road, she starts like aggressively defending this new aspect in her life, her candle era, as we would say today. And it's almost like, is this like a lightly touching on battered women syndrome? Is she like super defending this guy, this force that is taking her agency away? And then does the other moral of the story end up being, if you have a friend in this situation, don't stop being that person's friend. Fight for them. And when they need an out, be that ticket. Get them out.
Yeah. There's some nice stuff in regards to that. And like, I really do like that. you know, that it probably should have been something I mentioned in plot, but I like that the kind of big thing that snaps her out of it is when she would have had to leave Picard to die. And we know, you know, if we're regular viewers, how close they are, whether we, you know, whether it's about the will they, won't they, or not, we just know that they're close. They have a really good bond, and she actually snaps out of it because she wouldn't do that. I mean, she's a doctor. She wouldn't let anybody die, but let alone Picard, given what they, you know, what they mean to each other. So I did kind of like that respect. And I kind of also liked that, I actually think Patrick Stewart and Marina Sirtis, in terms of the acting, come off the best, because they're the ones that kind of have the level heads and point out all the things to Beverly that I would hope somebody would in this situation. If we, you know, stretch that metaphor to Troy, even gets to do the really cool like psychobabble thing. Like, whether you like it or not, she's the one that's like, you've both suffered a loss, and you can often, you know, it can feel like you've got a connection, but it's not real. It's, you know, can you step back and think about this objectively? And yeah, I like that it kind of touches on these ideas of like, you know, knowing, especially with Troy being an empath, like knowing that, yeah, I get that you feel this, but the reasons for it might be less than kosher, I guess, is the way to look at it. So
yeah, absolutely. And I think that I also found it interesting that her having such a close friendship with her, no one really, until she resigned, questioned the behavior she was exhibiting. And that's real, to me, real interesting. You know, I mean, maybe they couldn't fit it into the storyline. I don't know. But I just found it interesting that people who claim to know you so well, and you don't seem to want to stop and do a little intervention here and go, hey, Beth.
They had no reason to believe that there was anything dodgy. I mean, Troy was being a good friend in the regard that when she thought Ronan was just a person that she'd met, she's like, oh, Beverly, if I didn't know better, I'd say, oh, girl, you got some. Well done. You know, you're having a great time. Why not? You know, but it's not like, I don't think she would have reacted the same way if Beverly had been like, well, this ghost that my grandma was having sex with,
maybe
turns out
right,
he's a really good lover. I doubt Troy would have been like, yeah, get some, Bev, go for it. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Okay. You know what? I changed my mind on that theory. I'll give him that much.
Yeah. But no, I mean, she does, like I said, when Beverly does take it too far, she's like, I'm resigning, I'm just going to stay here. It is, I mean, even Deanna's like, yeah, this is way too rash of a decision, and it's not like her at all, and there's something weird and sinister going on here. So in terms of the acting then, we've kind of touched on it, most people, but I just wanted to say as well, I in terms of Duncan Regier, I already mentioned I don't think he's a particularly great actor when he's Shakar, and I don't think he's especially great here. But the one overriding thing that bugs me more than anything is that he's talking with like an upper class English accent, but says multiple times that he was from Glasgow.
Yes, that confused me. I said, am I not hearing the accent right? Am I one of those Americans who think all the people in Europe sound British? I can't be that person. No, why can't I hear it? Because I'm hearing it from the other ones. I can't hear it from him. He's terrible.
I just say Duncan lied.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, he doesn't even attempt a Scottish accent, and it's like, with no, again, the episode does ridiculous things with a straight face, but with no sense of irony, to just go like, I was originally born in Glasgow on Earth. Oh, and he has a Scottish phrase or something to try and say it, and still says it with an English accent at some point. He's like, oh, I didn't think you should do that, lassie. But yeah, I mean, to the same point, I really think the actor who plays Ned Quinn, I think he's a fine actor, but that Scottish accent, let's just say he must have spent a lot of time in Ireland, Jamaica, and the American South, because he's hitting everywhere other than Scotland with that attempt, I tell you what.
It was a hot mess. He was traveling with that accent. He truly was.
He was, but I like the actor. I think he's doing his best with that kind of cliche character of like,
but at least he tried. Didn't do it.
He did.
At least he tried. Like, yes, it's bad. You could have done better. You could have hired a speech coach, but you tried.
Yeah.
More so than the other guy did, so.
Absolutely. But yeah, the only other note I have, I really do want to point out, I think Patrick Stewart was great during his confrontation with Ronan in the house with Beverly, when he's actually kind of standing up for her and doing his, the line must be drawn here kind of situation. So I always love a bit of righteous fury from Picard.
Every time he says a line that way, I could just imagine him, you know, taking out his gun for a duel or his sword, you know. And I love the fact that he knew something was up with this guy, and yet he stood up for her without having all the information.
Yeah, and exactly.
He's like, no, something's happening here and we got to stop it.
It's great, though, that he's the one that applies the actual, like, real-world logic, because he's like, perhaps everybody's a little bit confused that they've never seen you, and where were you from? How did you get here? What ship were you on? I'd like to see the ship manifest. And he's like, Picard, with the actual, you know, questions that people should have asked about, you know, 3 days ago, but okay.
Exactly.
So, one thing about Duncan Regier that I just learned and the last 2 minutes of research is that he actually did go on to be in a Daniel Steele flick. So,
no,
that is perfect. That is just absolutely that is delicious so, irony.
That's
right,
actually
there.
Painful. Oh,
I have one bit of information, which just obviously the episode is directed by Jonathan Frakes. I think it might have been his first credit or one of his first credits of directing. He says, "I drew a good straw because it wasn't a Star Trek. It was more like Tales from the Crypt. Gates and I have worked well together, and she was never better than in Sub Rosa, and never looked more beautiful. She looked like a movie star." I mean, yeah, that's fair enough. But yeah, so any thoughts on the direction? I only have a few very minor notes. Any thoughts of anything that stood out from the direction of the episode from either of you guys?
You know, Jonathan Frakes has proven himself over the years to be a fantastic director. This was not one of his shining moments, but I think that that's, again, a writing issue, not a director issue. I think you're doing a job and you're doing the best you can with what you're given to do that task with. Okay. So.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And what about you, Doug? How do you feel about the directing?
I definitely think that some of the things that we were talking about where it felt like, you know, one of the person's performances didn't come across so well. You had mentioned like Beverly saying something kind of sound phoned in, if I may summarize. And Jonathan is known for being two takes Frakes. So in his effort to come in under budget, maybe he just went with the best take he could. And sometimes that doesn't always translate well.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a directing issue. It was the writing just gave Gates McFadden on a couple of occasions just blatant exposition dumps. And somebody should really have stopped and been like, can we make this more naturally sound like the way a human would talk and not a computer? You know, it's just, it was very, we need this information out there. Let's just give her it.
Anyway. I think this was his 10th outing as a director.
Really? Oh, I thought it was one of his first. Okay.
He did 8 TNG episodes, of which this is the last for that series. But he also did 2 episodes of DS9 prior to this date.
Fair enough. I know he also directed a few Voyagers and many an episode of Discovery and Picard, etc. So,
yeah.
Okay, cool. I only have just a few notes of things that I thought were notable that were actually a little bit of praise I want to heap on the episode, because we know Frakes is a good director and there were things he appreciated. So things like, I like the atmospheric green lighting and the way that kind of links into the anaphasic nature of whatever this Ronan thing is. But I think keeping that theme and having the lightning appear green and this kind of green hue, I think almost throughout, I think really works for me. I loved the scene when Ronan just appears in the mirror 1 minute and then isn't there the next. That's kind of straight from your kind of vampire type horror movies, and it's done really effectively. I found myself laughing at this, but laughing in all the right ways, because it's funny, but it's like intentionally funny. The idea that like there's fog on the bridge because the weather station's malfunctioning. And again, it's just like, it's this clash of like fantasy, erotica, ghost story with sci-fi. The idea that they're walking around on the bridge in fog and Picard's like, well, I'll just go and get my jacket. And I'm like, any other notes on, I may as well say anything because I don't really have any others and I wanted to, you know, move us along a bit quicker. So anything to do with the direction, the VFX, production design, music or sound that you wanted to shout out from the episode?
Nope.
No.
Awesome. I believe we have exhausted all of the critique of this episode.
We shredded it to pieces.
We did a little, yeah. I will say this is such a geeky spot, but I really like that Beverly's wearing the old Next Gen uniform in the picture of her with her grandma. Completely irrelevant to anything, but I was like, nice touch. Anyway, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to the next section, which is going to be our audience and critics response. With these being kind of less than popular episodes, I'm interested not just in what, you know, our general audience think, but also in what the critics made of the episode.
Incoming transmission.
So I'm going to start with the critical response and then move on to your thoughts on this. And tell you that, first of all, in 2016, fans at the 50th anniversary Star Trek convention voted Sub Rosa as the 6th worst episode of any Star Trek series. In 2017, however, it was ranked the 8th best romantic episode of Star Trek, noted for its exploration of sexual dreams. Okay. In 2016, Sci-Fi, the Sci-Fi Channel, included this episode in a group of Star Trek franchise episodes they felt were commonly disliked but deserved a second chance. In 2017, the episode was rated the 6th worst episode of Star Trek up to that time by Screen Rant. In 2019, they ranked it the 8th worst episode of the franchise based on the IMDb rankings of episodes to that time. And finally, for the critics, in 2019, Screen Rant included this episode on a list of bad one-off romances on the show, noting there's so many fans who prefer just to forget about the fact that Beverly and Ronan ever happened. Yeah, I really disagree with much of that. So yeah, over to you guys. I always put out a thing and ask you on the social medias what you thought of the episode in question. Got a lot of responses on Sabrosa, so I'm going to try and get through as many as I can. Sorry, I won't have time to get to them all, but hopefully we have a good little cross-section here. Right. So first of all, from where's this from now? From Mastodon, I should have said. Leland at Jazzburn at 10forward.social says, despite the reputation it has, I still find it entertaining. At Rita Singer at Bideback at Toot.Wales says, it's one of those Marmite episodes, hashtag Camp Erg. Hawkstar5 at bsky.social on Blue Sky says, honestly, I unironically love it. It's a gothic romance that somehow manages to be plausible in a sci-fi setting, feels both spooky and oddly romantic, and allows Beverly to be a sexual character on her terms. Plus, I live for cheese in my Trek. This one ticks all the boxes for me. Over on our Discord, our good friend Sandra, Sandra Evanson says, where was I? To be honest, I thought the idea was hot, but the execution was not. Okay. From my personal Facebook page, Justin Avery Smith, who's been on the show before. Hi, Justin. Had lots of thoughts on this episode, but to try and summarize a few, he said, personally, I just love to throw my head back and bow to the absurd. Star Trek, with its cast of conventionally good-looking characters in skimpy costumes, has always had a low level of perpetual horniness to it. You'd think bringing it to the forefront would bring some insightful commentary on that, but no. Instead, we get Dr. Crusher using a candle as a vibrator.
Yeah. He's so funny.
I know, he's cool. And the rest of it is basically all from Facebook groups. So first of all, from Star Trek VIP Nerd Lounge, sorry, Kale Clayton says, it made me cringe this episode. From Star Trek Fun Quadrant, the Great Big Meme Dump says, if nothing else, it's a great source for memes. Which, yeah, agreed. Where was I then? Star Trek Forever. Dennis Smith says, Duncan Regia was a sexy choice. Something you want to tell us there, Dennis. Stuart Marr says, being from Scotland, I liked the Scottish-themed planet. It even rained all the time. Greg Cox says, I give the show points for thinking outside the box here and trying for a change of pace. And I love how Gates McFadden has seemingly embraced all the jokes about this ep. And I'll also cop to laughing out loud when Lower Decks actually referenced Crusher's sex scandal. Yeah, Lower Decks is great for stuff like that, I think. So continuing with Star Trek Forever, Emily Lenore says, I will just say that I've always loved Duncan Regia, and when I first saw this episode, I was happy to see him playing a sexy, mysterious part. And then the episode kept going, and by the end of it, I felt sorry for him for being in such an embarrassing episode. That said, I still prefer him here than in DS9. His character there was so boring and had zero chemistry with Nana. At least he and Gates had chemistry, as wacky as that script was. Okay. From Star Trek TNG Fan Club, Simon Raymond says, generally considered the worst, I like it though. And David Anand Rajapaksi, apologies if I've mispronounced that, says, worst of next gen, definitely, but not worse than Threshold of Voyager. Obviously hasn't seen Code of Honor. From the group Simply Star Trek The Next Generation, Vanessa Olgan says, I loved it. I love the idea that a matter-of-fact scientist like Crusher can actually get drawn into the world of spirits. Also, the episode was beautifully filmed and reminded me vaguely of a Charles Dickens love story. So, okay, I can see your point, I guess. And moving back to Star Trek VIP Nerd Lounge, Jay Wu says, it always seemed clear that it was a riff on The Witching Hour by Anne Rice, a series that I always enjoyed and was also disturbed by. When it first aired, I thought its planetary and paranormal narrative was a great break from the ship. It was also nice to have an episode about Dr. Crusher, and I always thought Gates was underutilized. It hasn't aged well, and it seems hokey to most people, but I still enjoy it during rewatch. And that's all I have for your general thoughts out there. Editor Mike here chiming in. For the second week in a row, I do apologize. I had forgotten to get to the second part of my poetry corner. And so I did promise a haiku, and I have written one. So without any further ado, here is my haiku for Sub Rosa. Crusher screws a ghost.
who was her grandma's lover. Yeah, not weird at all. Probably not my finest hour, but hopefully you all appreciated it. And again, as I said last time, if not, apologies. It's only a few seconds at least. But yeah, back to the episode.
So bringing it back to those of us here on the podcast, it just remains for us to give our thoughts.
A spark. Analysis.
So I'm going to start, as I always do, with going around and asking everybody's favourite character, moment and line from the episode. Yes, we still have to do that even in less popular episodes. Apologies if it puts you guys on the spot. So, yeah, first of all, we'll start with favourite character. Dag, who's your favourite character from this and why?
Grandma Palpatine.
Awesome. Felisa She's Howard.
She's the only one who didn't have to do anything cringe the entire time.
Yeah. I will say the actress Ellen Albertini-Dow, I believe her name is, apparently almost did live to be 100. Bizarrely enough, like her character in this, but didn't sadly quite make it.
Yeah. And she was also the she was a theater teacher for one of the people who worked on the set as well, and they were surprised to see her.
Cool. Well, I would be surprised to see her doing what she does in this episode, that's for sure. But yeah, fair enough.
I'm glad we didn't get any flashbacks.
Don't tempt them. Anita, who was your favorite character and why?
You know, I'm tempted to say Beverly, but I think that that's like the obvious choice because she's the main character of this story. Believe it or not, the mayor. Here's this alien.
Oh, the governor of the...
The governor. He's not human, but he's embraced this human lifestyle. And, you know, he cares about the town that they've built there. And I kind of like the idea of all of that happening, that mixture and that diversity.
Cool. Awesome. I struggled to come up with a favorite character on this one because it sure as shit isn't Beverly as portrayed here. I'll say maybe Troy or Picard, and you know, let's just go with Picard for argument's sake because I'm a huge fan of the character in Next Gen anyway, and he does at least get to be righteously indignant. So yeah, so the next thing would be your favorite moment or scene. Dag, you're up first, please.
I'm not sure I have one. Wait, ask the question again. Hold on.
I mean, favorite. you can just pick Nana Palpatine again if you want.
I mean, the ghost lighting was definitely unexpected, and I was very, very worried that Data, being an android, was not going to recover.
Oh yeah, the attack on the weather station kind of thing. Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Oh yeah, and then of course the Palpatine thing. Got you. So what about you, Nita? What was your favorite moment or scene?
Oh, I loved when they're digging Grandma up and her eyes suddenly open and she sits up and kicks both their asses. I was dying. That was so funny. That was a little bit of my love of zombies and zombie movies and shows coming into Star Trek. You know, I mean, technically she wasn't a zombie, but, you know, as close to zombieism as Star Trek is ever going to get to is that moment.
Oh, that's what I've called it. Yeah, we're 3 for 3 because I've literally got written here under favorite moment. The zombie Nana bit is just an incredible bit of, they really did that, huh? And again, like you, I was just like laughing out loud, like, what? Even before I'd made the obvious Star Wars, you know, dark side lightning reference. Cool. So what was your favorite line in the episode, Dag? There's many to choose from.
I didn't write down anything specific.
Okay.
I don't know. Some of the very overcharged lines that Beverly delivers that you've already covered, you know, you're not Nana, you're an anaphasic life form. Just, I don't know. That tickles me.
I'll definitely accept that. Absolutely. So what about you, Nita? Does anything spring out to you as a favorite?
Oh, absolutely. The moment where Picard has had it and he's like, you know, you must draw the line here. I love that. I just love that whole, I'm going to be chivalrous and save the girl and oops, I'm gonna get my butt kicked and the girl's gotta save me moment that he had. But he tried. You gotta give it to the boy for trying. And I love that moment, you know, because he's standing up to this individual that he really knows nothing about. You know, where is he from? how strong is he? Can he, like, he doesn't have a clue. At least if you're standing up to like a Klingon, well, you know the level of their strength. There's no information here. And I love the fact that he's like, I don't care. I'm going to stand up for her.
Yeah, that's cool. Fair enough. I'm just glad no one's mentioned my favorite line, because just for comedy value alone, my favorite line is the incredibly brazen way that Picard, when hearing about Nana's relationship, says to Beverly, it would seem that the Howard women have exceptionally vigorous libidos.
Yeah.
I was just like, what is Picard trying to say? Is he saying like he's talking from experience with her? Is he hitting on her? What? That is just the most inappropriate way. He's like, oh, turns out your Nana's as horny as you are, eh? I mean, just like...
runs in the family.
Is there an HR person on this ship? I need to talk to HR.
For real. The things they do on this ship makes me wonder that there isn't human resources happening.
Oh, man. I mean, Barclay would have been sent to them immediately after those holo programs he'd been making. Come on.
Yeah. Oh, he would have been kicked out for sure.
I love how Star Trek, predicated deep fakes back in the 80s.
I know, right? Yeah. They're always at the cutting edge of new technologies, I suppose. Yes. But anyway, so yeah, that would bring us around to just have to give our conclusion and our score out of 5 Starfleet Deltas. Apologies, mine's a little long. I'm going to go last, though. So, Dag, I'll come to you first. What's your conclusion and your score out of 5, please?
This discussion has really like made me reevaluate the context in which I watched this episode. And I think I like some of the more darkly serious moments that we've had here. Mm. I'm going to give it 4 out of 5 candles.
Wow. 4. Okay. Fair enough.
I mean, what really about the makes you think? It really makes you think outside your own comfort zone and go, wait, there's a different message here, and maybe that message isn't for me.
Okay, fair enough. Nita, do you feel the same way?
I feel the same way, but I wouldn't score it that many candles for the same reasons I score it 2 candles.
2 candles, okay.
Yeah, and I'm like, yeah, you know?
Yeah, I see what you mean. I'm just going to read out what I've written, because I always try and get my thoughts down immediately after watching. I said, that was rough going. I didn't remember the episode being that bad. And it's not offensive, but it's absurd, laughable in all the wrong ways, and ultimately doesn't really seem to have a point, moral lesson, or worthwhile narrative to serve. But I'll give it this, it's not boring. Maybe even, dare I say, entertaining, though sometimes unintentionally, like Star Trek by Tommy Wiseau. I hate to disagree with Jonathan Frakes, but I think McFadden comes out of this looking absolutely ridiculous. I feel embarrassed for her. Simulating orgasms with thin air and reacting to Picard walking in on her. Well, you know what I'm saying. Then she's also given some of the worst, clunkiest expository dialogue I've heard in a long time. I can't write the episode off because its existence is worthwhile just for the laughs it gives when watching and beyond. I'm sure we've all seen plenty of memes. But it's insulting in the way it tries to shoehorn fantasy into sci-fi and does romantic melodrama really badly where other Trek episodes can succeed, usually with established relationships, but still. I can't feel too much vitriol at this, but it's definitely not good. Worth a look for comedy value and not much else, and Crusher deserves better. And I also gave it 2 out of 5. So, yeah, putting those scores together then, dividing by the 3 of us here, gives a final score for Sub Rosa of 2.6 out of 5. Which, weirdly enough, is pretty much exactly the score that Threshold got last week in our first of these episodes. So, yeah, bizarre. Actually, I have it. Yeah, I'm going to have a quick look and see. I think it's either exactly the same or very close. Actually, Threshold only got 2.1. So this is doing slightly better at 2.6. And I guess it is slightly above average. So we kind of have to call it a hit, I suppose. Very soft hit, but hit nonetheless. And I think, Dad, you did all the heavy lifting there with your score of 4 to get it where it's at with that. So, yeah. So that's it then. With Ronin vanquished, it just remains for me to thank my guests for joining me on the episode. Thanks, Dag. Thanks for coming on and your insights.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me.
And Nita, yeah, thanks for coming on too. And Dag, where can people find you on the internet?
Trek Nexus at on Blue Sky.
Jack Nexus on Blue Sky.
Where I live now.
Fair enough. And Nita, what about you? Where can people find you online if they want to see more of you or hear more of you?
They can find me on most social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, X, all under Sci-Fi Queens, and on YouTube, our Sci-Fi Queens podcast as well. And if I may, our next episode will be October 4th at 8 p.m. Eastern time.
Awesome. Fantastic. Always do check that out. It's a great podcast. And I know that you've got a link tree that I managed to find on one of your pages. So I'll always link that in our description as well.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
I found it when I was doing the little notes for the King Kong episode of the Silver Screen podcast that just went out. So, yeah. Which, by the way, is doing really well. So, yay.
Yes, it is. We have fun with that one.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. And if you want to find more from me and the podcast, there will be something up on screen that I'll edit in if you're watching this on YouTube, which will have all the places you can find us on socials. You can usually find me or the podcast. I run the podcast once. But if you want to reach DK for any reason, I'll always pass on the message. And if you're not watching this and you're listening to it on any various podcast platform, don't worry. There will also be my link tree or the podcast's link tree in the episode description, so that you can find us anywhere you'd like and do, you know, comment, share, interact, make it known that you're watching and hopefully enjoying these episodes as we diversify a bit into less popular territory. But we're not done after just two episodes. Oh, no. Next week, DK is back and he and I are both going to be shouting Alla Moraine as we play a game from the Gamma Quadrant. Yes, we're going to be moving along home next week. And do join us for that. Thanks again so much for sticking with us, viewers, listeners, and my guests. And do come back. In the meantime, remember, you're not Nana. Leave her alone. We are Starfleet. Live long and prosper.
Live long and prosper.
You have been listening to the Hit or Miss Star Trek podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson and DK. Produced and edited by Mike Wilson. Additional material by DK. Please remember to like this episode and spread it throughout subspace. Subscribe to the Hit or Miss YouTube channel and follow us online. Links to all of our social media pages can be found via the link tree listed in the episode's description. For any queries or to apply to be a guest on the show, you can also email homstartrek@gmail.com. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcasts Network. You can listen to this and our sister podcasts on all good podcast providers by searching for Mike's Podcasts. Hit or Miss Podcast was based on an idea by Michael Wilson and Will Templer. Thank you for joining us. We hope you'll be back, but for now, hailing frequencies closed.
I'm going to warp out of here at once, maximum speed.